got the same as talking about piecework. When I used to work fast, Barney thought I was so good. And they did say, if two passers didn't try, I said, oh, I'll do it, I'll do it. After I went to that meeting, I never worked one passer again. I sat out. I said, you get two passers. I learned, you know, that it was a union deal, not just the fact that I could, you know, I hadn't thought of it before.
Yeah.
But I never did that. I sat there till I got two passers.
Right.
And I learned, you know, not to do that.
Because it would be a way for them to sort of institute.
That's right.
Speed up in
that. That's right. That's all I was doing. And I didn't realize it because I could do it. I thought, okay, I'll do it. But I learned to sit there and demand. And so you learn as you go.
So that was sort of like a question of union consciousness. Were the unions and the guys, I guess, really concerned with ensuring that the women had that kind of consciousness?
Well, all the men didn't, because a lot of them had to get it too, you know. But the leadership in the boilermakers was, not in the sheet metal workers at all. They just had to put up with this. But in the boilermakers union and any progressive unions, they certainly were interested in political education. And that's why I'm sorry they lost the copies of the main deck, because that was full of political education. The question of, you know, it was geared.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of concern. And a lot of them, too, were trying to, when they said, trying to hold our wages down, it came in that paper, wrote that up, too, and explained. And a lot of men took the position, not all of them, because a lot figured, you know, when you're home, you're going to look after the kids, and that equal pay for equal work, which is still going on. That's 35 years. That was the beginning of it at that period, although I think in history it was a long, long time before with women in those sweatshops. And it's still going on, but equal pay only, all they did was cut the men's wages if they didn't give us the same, and some got it through their heads. Equal pay for equal work. And that's still a problem. That's not finished with. But we had a lot to say about that, that they gave us less, and all it did is cut the men's wages. They could hire us for less. And a lot of men began to realize that right within the craft union, right within the sheet metal workers union, as a matter of fact. They began to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Even the most conservative began to see that.
Right. What kind of role did the stewards play? Were they really important in terms of
The shop steward is the most important key figure in any union. And they weren't all good. They're just people. Some of them were excellent and some of them just collected dues. It depended on the person and their political understanding.
Mm-hmm.
But some were excellent and a lot of the women were good. You know, and I can't even think of their names, but they, you know, some even remember their faces. But it just depended on the person. But actually the shop steward is one of the most key, because this is the direct contact with the working people. This is the person that helps with the negotiations, that takes the immediate problem to the union, and still is one of the key people. A shop steward shouldn't be just a dues collector, but they often are.
Right.
You know, they often are. But any problem that arises, or infringement on union or anything else, goes through the shop steward. He or she is the first to find it out and to negotiate with. It's a very important union job.
Were they were elected in the boilermakers and the other unions, right?
The shop steward is elected, I believe,
yeah,
through the union, off the floor. But I'm not sure how they did it because I never was one. But
right,
it seems to me they were.
Were there many women stewards?
There were quite a few,
Did they deal primarily with women?
I think they just dealt with women. But I'm not sure, but I think so. I think they dealt with women because we were still sort of, we hired out in a different hall with a woman leader, and I think that they dealt, when I talked to them, it was always the women they dealt with. So I think they dealt with women.
Okay, so.
But I'm not sure, but I think so.
Right. How did the union generally deal with women and women's issues separately from other members of the union? How did women get integrated into the union?
Oh, they had to be into the union. They had to join.
Right, because it was a close shop.
Yeah. And in the boilermakers, you had right of voice and vote, not just voice. And so you participated much more freely and fully.
Mm-hmm.
And had much more impact. You were pretty equal
right
in a union like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, but in the craft unions, I don't think. I think you just took your body there. Most of them didn't even go to them.
How did the women react to that?
Well, it depended on the person. Just like men, some women just joined the women union because they had to and never thought of it at all past that. Mm-hmm. And other women began to understand like I did.
Right.
And so I guess it just depended on the person. There were a lot of active women in the union.
There were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very active. Uh-huh. And there was something to do. I remember when I was in the sheet metal workers when I didn't know anything about dress. And I can't remember what the issue was. This woman named Bonnie was our shop steward. And I know I didn't understand what she was getting at. I was only in just a few months. And it was something to do with our dress. And I can't remember, but I think it had to do with not just safety measures, because they were, that was all over safety measures. You had to wear your hard hat and your hair bound mm-hmm. in a bandana so it didn't get caught in the shimmy or catch on fire and something, because it's dirty and hard work out there. But it had to do with something that they felt infringed upon, and I can't remember what it was, that we all took a delegation up. You know, I can't remember what the issue was now. But I know she was pretty smart and, mm-hmm. and seemed to know what she was doing. She had some political understanding.
Yeah, right. Okay, so there were women who were active in the union, and then there were other women as well as men who were just sort of there. How did the men relate to the women activists? Did they encourage that? Were they?
Oh, no. Once we were in, it was very easy. At the first, there was all this grumbling. As soon as we were there, no, pretty well accepted.
Yeah.
You know, there may be the oddball that looked at. No, we were very well accepted and worked nicely together. In fact, the men liked working with us.
Yeah, one of the questions I asked about the union was because there were sort of all these debates and struggles going on around the CCL and the Boilermakers and so on. And one of the things that I wondered is if maybe some of the men would get upset around the women being able to determine policy and stuff like that if they weren't seen as permanent workers.
I think there were men like that that argued that we're all going to go back and do the yeah. dishes anyway. But in the Boilermakers Union, that wasn't any policy at all in that union.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That was, in fact, their whole thing was equal pay for equal work.
Right.
That you only cut your own throat.
Which is true.
Yeah.
So the issues that the women were concerned with were child care, equal pay for equal work, and were there other sort of central issues? Oh, peace work. Which was a general union concern.
Yeah, I don't know how many women were on that, understood it, actually, because a lot of men didn't understand it. But it was a union issue.
Right.
But I don't know how many, you know, it was dependent on the person, the understanding of that. It wasn't a big cry of women. They didn't, it wasn't, it was just a general thing.
Right.
One of the issues was that we talked about a lot was after the war and industry and developing industry and a chance for jobs to continue. And a lot of women were concerned with that because after all, they've worked now. And as I said, a lot of women were buying back their self-respect. Some were just able to pay off stuff. A lot of them had made better arrangements with their husbands. There were some separations over it. But you had a new status. It was the beginning of the change, actually, in this decade of being accepted equally in industry, which is still going on, but mm-hmm. I mean, it was the beginning of it. And we really had a lot of worries about work, and at that time, we thought we were going to build a big merchant fleet. But of course, the government sold ours to Panamania or whatever they've got, and we don't have one, which is, to me, absolutely unthinkable. With two big coastlines and all our raw materials that we're dishing out, that we don't even have a merchant navy. We also had, and I think even wrote a column on it once, about a secondary industry, how things could be, like through the aircraft factories, that we could be making other things. And I don't remember all the things we thought up that we could be doing, but we did have some ideas on it. And that was quite a concern of both men and women, actually,
mm-hmm.
was continuation of jobs that weren't just wartime jobs, or we didn't need a war to work.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I know I wrote even my little column on it, and it was a lot of discussion. We used to talk about it a lot because everybody remembered 10 or 12 years with no work.
Yeah.
And
not wanting to go back.
No, people wanted to feel that they were a continuation of jobs, and that we were and we had the feeling that things would change now, that they, if they can find all this money for war industry, surely they can find it for peacetime. And we talked about industrialization of the country and raw materials. We hadn't talked about ecology yet. That came way after, because we hadn't thought about ecology yet. We were still just worrying about building, you know. And so that was a concern of both men and women, pretty strong. And certainly was with women who didn't want to go back and have to beg for their living, and wanted to continue working, and that's, and wanted to fight for it, wanted daycare, and wanted some independence and equality. And it was pretty a lot talked about in amongst the women.
When did they start laying off in the shipyards?
Oh, I guess the end of the war.
Mm-hmm. So how did that process happen?
I don't.
First,
oh, I guess the women went first, you know. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the women would go first when in the layoffs. And at that time, I had quit the shipyards.
Right.
Before the end of the war, I quit the shipyards because I started to get this yellow jaundice again, and it was hard on me to work, and I hurt my leg, and it was hard on me to work out there. And at that time, you were frozen on your jobs, too.
What is that mean?
Well, they froze you during the war. When you worked, you couldn't go from job to job.
Oh, wow.
You had to go through, we were then fighting for unemployment insurance about that time, too. That was one of the issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that they had started a little bit before, when everybody got a box of groceries or the kids were put out in camps. But during the war was one of the big fights through the unions and everything for unemployment insurance and security. In fact, some people in some places went to jail in picket lines for unemployment insurance.
Wow.
And I was on some demonstrations or meetings, big meetings on the question of unemployment insurance. And it came up legally sometime around in there, but I don't remember when. But that was one of our issues, too, of mm-hmm. some sort of social security, if there wasn't employment.
Okay, so unemployment insurance was one of the big issues. Okay, and women were concerned in the industries about losing their jobs. I know you were working there, but do you have any sense of what began to happen and how people reacted in the shipyards when the layoffs started around the war? And whether people at all sort of tried to fight back? Did they mostly fight back around the issue of Social Security and...
Yeah, there was a lot more. I don't know precisely how, but there was a whole change of attitude. They weren't accepting anymore. It was a whole change with both men and women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just people work, and there was a whole different attitude in general against being shoved anymore into a depression with no work. And unions really developed through the war, were able to organize. That's when most of them got so much strength. They say it's a poverty builds unions, and as a matter of fact, poverty demoralizes people. They develop more when people felt secure
mm-hmm.
and had some power.
Yeah.
And the unions really developed during that period. They had that no strike pledge, of course, that went on.
Mm-hmm.
But after the war, when they stopped the no strike pledge, I worked on the strike of the IWA in 1946, and that was for the 40. It was a 44-hour week at that time, and that was one of the first big strikes after the mm-hmm. no strike, when they wiped out the no strike pledge, and when the union started then to take some form of action against the government. And that's right, and the right to negotiate, the right to strike. They're still at it, but because, you know, it depends on the pressure, it's back and forth on the government, but withhold their labor power and so on, and that was a big strike
mm-hmm.
in 46.
I'd like to ask you about that. I'm going to try and finish off the shipyard stuff first, and then maybe we can
All right.
talk a bit about that. How did people relate to working in a war industry? Like, was there, and did you feel like conflict between wanting to produce for the war, and then also defending union rights and fighting around wages and that kind of stuff. Was that an area where...
There was no conflict.
Yeah.
And we never thought about it too much, that it was just war industry and is this the kind of big business we should be in or anything. It was a different attitude of that war.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an anti-fascist war in their mind.
Sure.
You know, it wasn't like the question of Vietnam, which has opened up a lot, a new idea about war to the general mm-hmm. public. Mm-hmm. And we didn't understand big industry or monopoly capitalism particularly. We just wanted peacetime jobs.
Right.
And to continue to industrialize the country, and felt that they can supply for war, they can supply for peace, but there was no feeling that it was... against the war.
To fight against peace work and that kind of thing.
Well, that came up with the union. Peace work was, and that wasn't in every union.
Right.
That was the Marine and Boilermakers Union, and maybe others, but that was the union I was in.
Right.
And that's the one I remember. And most of the craft unions, I don't think, took up such a fight against it.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of them were, of course, against the Federation, because they were old-time craft unions, and they didn't feel like
mm-hmm.
incorporating themselves into an industrial union.
So people, you know, both in the unions and also like the shipyard owners and stuff like that, and the government didn't attack you for trying to establish union rights within a war industry?
No.
No.
Well, they did, really. There was a lot mm-hmm. of conflict, you know, but there wasn't direct.
Right.
Of course, there was no strike pledge, but there was negotiation and propaganda, but I don't remember exactly, but I don't remember any. We didn't have any conflict because there were no strikes in the first place. You didn't, you know, there during that time or withhold
mm-hmm.
labor power, which is when you start fighting.
Yeah.
And, but they had certainly worked against it.
Yeah, right.
Particularly the shipyard owners.
Yeah.
But I don't remember all the different ways. That would have been written up in the main deck, but I can't remember now. You know, certainly it wasn't popular with ship owners.
Okay, you talked before about a fight to establish daycare. Was that mostly outside of the framework of the union?
Oh yeah, that was right without outside. The union and the Marine and Boilermakers backed us up. I don't know whether they did it physically or just morally, but I know they did morally and so on, but they didn't participate, as I can remember, officially. It was mostly women's committees. And I forget the name of those committees, you know. They had different committees.
And were those committees, like, was that a union committee?
Or? No. I don't think so. They were just committees on child care and really women's committees. And there were other women that worked in aircraft and other women that just worked. And it wasn't necessarily through the shipyards.
And was it mostly working women who were involved in fighting for?
Well, yeah, care? Yeah. And then other women, too, that understood, you know. And we had other women in it. I don't remember them all. I just remember going with delegations and sitting at meetings and discussing a lot. But I just can't recall all the things we did. But I know that it was a long, long time. We kept at it and kept at it. And it would pop up and then sort of die down and pop up again. And we'd have halls and we sent in resolutions and to governments. And we sent in documents and we sent in data and we did research and... It just seemed to go on and on and on the necessity of it, and I think they're still doing it.
Yeah, because Britain and the United States had daycare programs during the war.
Possibly.
Yeah. I mean, not good ones, but they had
something, but we didn't.
Yeah.
No, and we had some little things that were independent. Now we started just before the war and during it, before I worked in shipyards, in a neighborhood, old neighborhood house. Some of us got together, like they did these little. Mother's daycares in the 50s. And we got together and I worked on that because my littlest boy was still more or less a baby, 3 or something. And I worked on that committee and we ran it ourselves, like the mothers would hire a teacher or one would be the teacher and we'd all take turns and we rented part of this hall and renovated it. But it was like a play school more. It wasn't a daycare for people could work. It'd be a 2-hour morning affair. And it was from that actually that developed a lot of the committees.
Okay. Did you work before you went into the war industry? So
no, I never worked.
So that was your first job?
Yeah, it was my first job and I was on the loan. There wasn't any work. And if I had been, I wouldn't have been able to anyway. I was 17 years old when I started having children. I was just 18 when my boy was born, and I had three at 21. And so if there had been, I wouldn't have worked. And if there wasn't any work anyway, nobody worked.
Okay, so after you had left the shipyards, you got involved with the IWA. Were you working in the wood industry?
No. Well, after I left the shipyards, I got a job as a reporter on the People from my column. And this was a left-wing paper.
It was the LPP.
Yeah, the Labor Progressive Party paper. And I had, you see, while I was working in the shipyards, I got an idea for a review because of all the different people, and I couldn't write it. And I went up to this paper. I had met all of these people, but I was reading their paper in the shipyards. And it was pretty bright. And I talked to a girl named Cynthia Carter, who was a writer there. And then there was her boyfriend, who was Freddie Wilmot, who was a black fella. And he was a very clever, he wrote poetry. And I got people from the shipyards. One fellow named Stan Randall that was a musician. And Kitty Carson was somebody else I met along. She was a musician. Anyway, Cynthia and Elsie put it together. I thought up the ideas, and they were very clever with dialogue. And we put on a review, and it was something like Pins and Needles. They say, and I think Kitty Orchestra wrote the music for it, and we had John Goss came with this fellow that conducted fires, came down and helped us with the singing. We actually put the damn thing on a little hall on Homer Street, which has now been torn down a long time ago, and Dorothy Somerset, I believe, from UBC came down and finally pulled it together. She knew how to produce it, and they say it was as clever as anything, you know, what we'd done as Pins and Needles had we carried it on. And it was all short skits. And at that time, the United Nations was the big deal. And the big song was United Nations with flags on something, and flags unfurled. What in the hell are the words of that thing, United Nations? To victory, anyway. It was the big, that was sort of the overall picture with the United Nations. And that was our theme of the whole thing. So I had worked on that. And then after I met them, well, and I got sick, well, they said, did I want to, maybe could be a reporter and rewrite on the paper. So they published an ad, and I had to go through, I quit the yards, but I was, as they say, jobs were frozen. So I had to go through the unemployment office and apply for it and go up and interview them. And so that's how I was allowed to change jobs. So I worked on that paper. I worked on that paper for about a year. That was still during the war.
Right.
For about a year.
As a journalist?
Well, I wasn't really much of
well.
You can't say I was a journalist. I rewrote and covered stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I went out and covered things.
Okay.
And Cynthia did a City Hall column, but I covered the Labor Council sometimes and never quite understood what was going on.
Were there women delegates to the Labor Council in that period? Were there any women who sat on it?
Well, there must have been, but I can't remember.
Yeah. Do you remember running into any stuff about women unionists and any of the stuff going on in other unions or other sectors, I guess, other than the shipyards?
No, but I remember a lot of stuff going on with the hotel and restaurant workers because that was women. Women led that union. And I knew those women, and they were left-wingers. And that was right during the war, shortly after. And in that union was very right-wing in the States. And we were affiliated, you know, with the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union, because I worked in a restaurant for a while, too. I did a lot of little things. And I know that when the delegates, we sent our delegates to the States, some of them were refused, and it was almost gangster-led in the States. And our delegates came back just terrified. They said one woman was shot, I think it was in Chicago. And actually that union was raided and our in Vancouver, and I don't exactly know how it all went out, but I can, if I think of her name, I'll tell you who to see about that union. She was an organizer at that time. And I'll think about it. I just saw her a while ago. She was the other woman is dead, but this one woman, May Lenichek is her name, and she lives in North Vancouver. She's an older lady now, but she was an organizer at that time.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah, I'll find her for you, because she was an organizer at that time, and that union was raided, and I think they even came up with guns, you know, into, because it was, and I, at that time I was working, when that happened I was working in the Loggers Union, so it would be about 46, but before that they'd had long struggles, and we were raided, and our executive was thrown out. But I don't know how all the ins and outs, but May could tell you, because okay, she was a union organizer at that time. Yeah.
Okay. So you got in. You were working with.
I was working on the paper, mm-hmm. on the Progressive paper. And I know one thing I did. I covered the first trainload of wounded that came back, and I never covered it again. I never was too good at that. If you want to hear about it, I can tell you about that, because it's printed on my memory forever.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, we all went in down at the sea in below Bramble Street, the Canadian, that the Canadian Pacific was in.
Yeah.
And they had us in a room down under, and had big pillars, and they had sort of platforms. The train came in, and they had the families of all the wounded, and they all stood around quiet with quite a bit of dignity, and they started bringing these kids off in stretchers and laying them up on these pillars. And we were then supposed to get their story from all these kids. And I was really almost devastated. I remember one boy, he couldn't have been over 19 years old, and he had, I think, both his legs and one arm off. He was a stump, anyway, just a stump. And he had married his... I sort of stood back and watched his face. He was from Italy. He'd been in Italy, and he was frightened. He had a young wife standing there, and he was frightened. And no way I could go up and ask him a question. His family were composed, and I was weeping behind the pillar. A reporter at that time, I knew, named Ray Gardner, and he's working on The Sun, very quietly worked through them, and he gave me information that I wrote on this boy. And there was another reporter, and she's very prominent today, and I won't say her name. And she was a 17-year-old reporter at the time, and she pounced in, and she says, "Well," she says, "how did you like Italy?" I never forgot her, and I won't mention her name and on this.
Yes.
And then there were others. I remember there was one boy who was Australian. He still had rosy cheeks. And his parents looked old at that time, oh, elderly, and the mother is quite composed, but the father actually crawled up to talk to him. And anyway, I wrote my story, and I never went and watched another train. It still upsets me, you know, to watch them,
horrible.
You know, bring them back, and I said, I can't go up and ask. Intrude on people like that, but it brought the war very close when you see them crutches and the eyes out and the legs off, and before it was something far away.
Yeah.
That was the first time it really emotionally hit my gut, what was happening to people and what a war is for, and what were they fighting for, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Yeah. One of the things I was wondering was, did a lot of the women who worked in the shipyards during the war, were they married to soldiers, guys, or were soldiers?
Quite a lot were. And after the war, there was a lot of problems. The kid had been sleeping with the mother for 4 or 5 years, and one of the big problems that was quite prevalent was how to get the kid out of the bed. Because he'd been sleeping with mama, he didn't like this stranger around, and there was really a lot of problems with these men coming back, and a 4 or 5 year old kid who didn't like him, and he was sleeping with mama and didn't want this stranger around. And that was quite a problem. It was very prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, really caused problems between, and the mother and father hardly knew each other anymore. Never mind this little brat that wasn't going to have this guy around. And it was a very great problem in many, many, many cases. It wasn't funny, you know. Really struggle to adjust the man to the kid, and the kid to the man, and yourself to the man, and move the kid out, and it was very hard.
Yeah.
A lot of women were just almost torn in two, between what to do. really emotionally just stuck, you know. Mm-hmm. And the man never knew the kid, maybe his, but it's a little, you know. So it was a real serious problem. But of course, my husband wasn't in the Army. And I had already left him anyway.